Hi, everyone. Okay. So you'll be happy to know that the Blue Jays got the toast this morning. This is good. This is good. And the deer are frolicking around in great joy. So all is well in Tisserand land. Quite a few questions came in just now. One caveat on yesterday about the teachers here in Tisserand are that we're really happy to meet everyone. It would be impossible to have a Dharma correspondence with everyone, email. It'd just be too much for us. So I'm sorry, we can't really. I already have a pretty rich correspondence in my life. And so coming to the monastery or coming to retreats is really the way you get to know teachers. Obviously, it'd be nice if I could sit all day and answer emails, but it just gets too much, isn't it? So that's just a caveat on what I said last night. So a lot of questions came in. One was back to that thing about social responsibility and what you can do, and the correspondent said, yeah, but old people can do a lot. They can vote, and certainly I totally agree with that. But I would say protect the mind from anger and righteous indignation, because, you know, like this person said, it feels like the 1930s and the kind of sink into fascism and so on. And yeah, it can be very frightening, but we are cultivating something which is deeper than all of that, and it just depends on what you're interested in. You know, if you're really interested in getting angry, okay, go for it. If that's what turns you on, as we say, then be angry. But how profitable is that, right? And how effective is that? So one wants to guard against righteous indignation and the anger which is right, because that's also been very destructive in human society on all edges of the spectrum. So can one be engaged without being angry? Don't know. I'm a monk. I've done this. But is there some logic in being engaged without being angry? Does that kind of make sense? Or is anger a necessary part of being engaged? And is enragement a necessary part of effective action? And I don't know. I tell the story in when I was at U of T in mid-60s, and there was the anti-Vietnam War protests were going on. And you probably, many of you heard this story, but there was a radical left dissident called Jerry Rubin, part of the Chicago Seven, for those who were around for the Chicago Convention in whenever it was, and Democratic Convention in Chicago. Well the seven guys were arrested for sedition, and he was one of them, and he was on bail before the trial, and he came to U of T and spoke, probably Convocation Hall. And it was an anti-Vietnam War protest. And, you know, I was against that war. And he put this Viet Cong flag around his shoulders. And he incited everyone to extreme anger. And I said, yeah, but I don't want to be like that. And, yeah, sure, it's maybe what you're saying is right in some kind of way. But do I want to become angry and self-righteous or whatever? I heard that later he became a stockbroker or one of those guys. I said, oh, yeah, that's the transformation. Not that you get stockbrokers. So anyway, I just thought in my own life, I thought I'd rather cultivate inner freedom and try to participate in wherever I participate from that. If I was in fascist Italy, 1935, what would I do? I don't know what I would do if I was in. Yeah, but anyway, these are the choices I had. So we all have choices because we're very fortunate to be here. So my question isn't so much how much you engage in social activism. My question is, does anger serve peace, let's say? Does an angry person serve peace in the world? Or maybe you think, well, just like being a monk and being peaceful in that way is not really going to stop the downward trend of societal corruptions and so on. Yeah. So you have to, in an ideal situation, the social activism becomes your vocation. And vocation always had that idea of God-given. And so monasticism is a vocation, family is a vocation, social activism could be a vocation. So for someone like Dr. King and Nelson Mandela again, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, they're socially activist, and that's their vocation, but it's also their spiritual challenge to remain loving in situations which are horrible, very, very horrible. Now, so did Nelson Mandela have any effect on the world from his profound ability to forgive? He did. Does His Holiness the Dalai Lama? He does. Can he stop the Chinese from doing what they, what has happened to the Tibetan people? No, right? Dr. King got killed. He got assassinated, right? So can you do social activism and also use it to take responsibility for anger? And that would be an interesting one. So that the vehicle is, let's say, whatever issue you want to be involved in, global warming or racial injustice. Okay, you choose something that you might have some power and effect in because you have that relationship in society and you have the resources, you need the resources. And then you use that to understand anger and liberate your heart from anger. And that would be like social activism as a spiritual practice rather than, because it's just too easy to blame your anger on other people, isn't it? It's really easy to do. I mean, I can find lots of things in the world I can hate. But it's like Toni Morrison saying that goodness is difficult. It's not easy to do activism and do it as a spiritual practice. So that's not easy to do. But it's an interesting challenge. So whatever you choose, I've chosen this, you choose what you want to choose, but can it be a way of always being responsible for your own mind and from your own heart and always moving towards compassion? That would be a kind of Buddhist ideal. But it's hard to do, yeah. I mean, and who can I, who am I to talk? I became a monk. But I didn't become a monk to run away from social responsibility. I just knew I had to do training. I needed to do the undergraduate work of the mind. And then things have evolved, so I'm here now. So that's it. How do you address that? Each of us addresses that in our own way. And another question was around how do you, this is completely different, change modes from social to transcendent. How do you hang out more in the silence at the end of thought, right? Because I think the person who's asking this question now has a taste of that. Yeah, I kind of tune into that a bit. Oh yeah, okay, I get it. I see what that's, what's being indicated. So then for me it would be noticing in meditation especially, noticing the tendency to try to get rid of thought. And then making the end of thought something that you're very conscious of more and more. And in that moment of noticing, you somehow create a positive perception of, this is it. I don't have to go anywhere, as opposed to, oh God, I'm thinking too much. That shift from a critical judgment of thought, which isn't necessarily, you know, it's not that analytical. It's just this kind of reaction to thought and then moving to the object of meditation. But it's not coming from awakening. It's coming from resistance and rejection. It's very quick. It's very, very quick. And so to just make conscious the end of thought by doing the exercises we're doing, and they say, this is it. Kind of really affirming that and making that important. And then if you affirm that and you say, that's it, I don't have to do anything else, even just a little bit, then the next time it happens, you tend to affirm that and won't go into desire to get rid of thought. And you keep doing that. 20 years? So remember, this is very subtle. It's very, very subtle. But once you have the taste of that, you know, the kind of nectar of silence, then you will incline towards that. You will do that, but the old habits will be there. This is the frustrating part of the contemplative life, is even though you have insight, the power of habit overwhelms the insights that you have. And that's very frustrating. And there's just the way it is. The part of this whole business is frustrating, which is okay. But then if you just keep remembering, and then like in situation, like it's, waiting is very good. You know, when you're waiting for the whatever, the boss or the traffic jam or the dentist. Do people still go to dentists nowadays? Or is that not allowed? It's allowed, okay. You know, you're just waiting there, nothing to do. So then when there's nothing to do, you want to do something. So you pick up the whatever magazine you like in the collection of magazines, or you know, you scroll through your emails, or you do something, right? Well, why don't you do nothing? You know, there's nothing to do. Why do anything? So then you just abide in a witnessing. You sit there and witness. But you notice the mind wants to do something, and that's the movement of thought, really, and of becoming and doing. It's okay, you know, it might be an interesting magazine, and you could answer your emails. So, but this, they're like, oh, well, there's nothing to do, and then listen to the silence. Can take those little opportunities that do exist in life, and obviously the more you introduce them into your 24 hours of a day, the more they'll become conscious. That silence will become conscious. So there is this huge habit of filling the mind, isn't there? And we've got really nice toys to fill the mind, or really horrible toys to fill the mind. You know, you can, but it is this constant going out, isn't it? And then consuming. So that's what a consuming society does. And we might not be consuming, you know, really gross material objects. So we are consuming information a lot. The mind does like to go out a lot. And the mind going outside, you know, that the way that Lompa Dun says, the mind going outside is the cause. The result of the mind going outside is suffering. The mind knowing the mind is the path. The result of the mind knowing the mind is the end of suffering. You know the mind, you know knowing. And you begin, so the more you intend that, the more it'll happen, really. But I don't know any, you know, secret quick methods that would work. I tried drugs, that didn't work. That messed it up even more, so I don't recommend that. But a lifestyle which is non-distracting helps in that way. You know, a lifestyle which doesn't stir the mind so much, where that sense of silence becomes really, really more and more obvious. Okay, let's do some more meditation. Awakening to the way things are. Simple, isn't it? And then thought makes it complex. So come to the simplicity of knowing. And then what language do you use to stay there? Like what I was just saying earlier, this is it. This is the goal, this knowing. And then you can create something pleasant, affection of some way in the heart, welcoming. The end of the out-breath, curiosity. So whether it's affection or curiosity, both are aspects of awakened knowing. They're not, in curiosity, you're not trying to get an experience. You're looking at your experience right now, like say the end of the out-breath, just as a scientist in a lab is looking at certain procedures. But then the affection is one of a warmth and an attitude which really helps you sustain this capacity for awareness. So those are kind of general principles. Somehow you need to either agree with them or disagree with them, but then if you find them helpful, how would you keep introducing those simple principles into the way you meditate? That's not a technique, is it? So let's just sit quietly with those thoughts. So maybe just a few thoughts on that last exchange we had around social activism and so on. Just remember that a monk can be very naive about these things. So the monastery is a kind of a place which lives not counterculture, but parallel culture. So it's a place that functions rather independently, although we're very dependent on the laity, but we're not beholden to a lot of the things or involved in a lot of things, obviously, that larger society is. And so monastery is a kind of place of reflection and contemplation about the Dhamma. And then the answers someone like me gives around social issues quite often, like, don't ask me about marriage. I wouldn't know what to say, right? So there's a kind of, but if you ask me about the mind and about greed, hatred, and delusion, then I can, you know, that's an area I can engage with because I suffer like you suffer, right? So we're all the same that way. But one thing, yeah, so those issues are difficult and we have different aspirations, maybe socially, how we want to do things. We have different resources, different possibilities of power or lack of power. But one thing I think to discern or to distinguish in Buddhism is the difference between hatred and anger. So hatred to me seems very pernicious, very destructive, and it's a really held position of the other who deserves my hatred, right? And that's very, very destructive for the individual and society. Anger is also, I mean, it can be problematic, but it's much, it's socially awkward to have people angry all the time, to say the least, or it can certainly be very painful because anger oftentimes goes out to the people closest to us, and that's very tragic, right? Because so anger has to be addressed too. But there is a massive difference between held visceral hatred of whatever, a group, as opposed to just the flare-up of anger and the habit of anger. And maybe just to recollect that story, which many of you I've told on retreats, of Sister Jitapala, who's the Cambodian nun in Amaravati, I think. Bodhipala. I always, who's Jitapala? She's the German. I always get those. There's the Jitapala and the Bodhipala, the two of our nuns. So Sister Bodhipala is the Cambodian nun, and she's probably a bit older than me, right? 80-ish? Yeah. Probably 80-ish in age, just a bit older than me. And she was in Vietnam when the Khmer Rouge took over, and she saw the violent, horrible death of many people in her family. And she fled Cambodia and ended up in the States. And she had a pretty good career. Was it in IT, or do you remember? I think she was a mathematician or something. Anyway, those parts I don't quite remember, but she did okay. But in the back of her mind was this huge hatred for the Khmer Rouge, justified. And she developed a practice of visually torturing Khmer Rouge soldiers. And then she, what I remember, I mean, she told me this many, many, many years ago, but she would imagine a soldier and she would have a razor and cut them up into smallest possible pieces to inflict the most amount of pain possible to them, constantly doing that. Now, you could say, yeah, I can understand that, but that's destroying you. And then she began to see that. She began to go back to her Buddhist roots. And then she really started to work on that and work on metta bhavana and develop a heart of forgiveness very sincerely. took a long time, a long, long time. Eventually, she made her way back to Phnom Penh, and she set up a refuge for abused women in Phnom Penh. And all the time now, she, you know, there's this transformation from hatred to forgiveness. And then this is the most stunning part of this. She decided that she wanted to go up to one of the villages, which was now neutralized, but she knew Khmer soldiers were in that area a lot. And although it was neutralized by the government now, she wanted to go up there to ask for forgiveness for all the hatred that she had had thrown at them, as it were. She went up there and found some ex-Khmer Rouge soldiers and asked for forgiveness, and they cried. And wow, you know, wow, what a human being can, you know, the transformation a human being can make. And yeah, you could say, yeah, the hatred is you could understand it, but it's just self-destructive more than that. And anyone around her, of course, would feel that. And now she's a lovely nun in Amaravati, and I think she can still flare up, right? You know, not often. Okay, but you know, you could see how you could get the answer is not often. But you could see how someone could still flare up, but there wouldn't be hatred, right? It's just you know, aggravation about something in life, and that's different. That's different. So we need to protect ourselves from that. And then forgiveness is not condoning. It's just not allowing the mind to go to hatred, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama. You know, he doesn't hate, but he understands the situation. And he's not naive in that way. And then, well, anger, then that's very habitual, very passionate. Some people are very, very passionate that way. And anger is a very quickly volcanic arising. So they have to just very patiently work on not believing in it, not going there, having body awareness, asking for forgiveness, mea culpa, that kind of a thing. But it is different, right? It is different than hatred. And that, and there's so much of that now, that divisions and through news and so on. So one has to be careful not to kind of buy into that. So tomorrow morning, you know, one of the things you might think of when we're not together is who got the toast, right? What I'm doing to you now is I'm putting a suggestion in your mind from Toast Stories throughout this retreat, and I bet you it'll come up. Right? I wonder who got the toast this morning. Now, is that you doing it? Are you thinking who got the toast this morning? Or is it nature in change? Huh? Well, anyway, when I see you, let me know. But don't send me an email, for goodness. Who got the toast? Okay, let's take a break, or keep practicing whatever you're doing, and we'll meet at 2 o'clock Ottawa time again. Bye for now.